Why were there so many plane crashes? What happened to a satellite? We'll be back in a moment with Bill Warrick on Coast to Coast AM. Bill, let's go through some episodes this hour. Next hour, we'll just open up the phone lines. And again, a special line from Phoenix and maybe even Norfolk. March 13th, 1997, 11:19 p.m. Eastern Time. Tell us about this episode called Troubleshooter 615.
Troubleshooter 615. I think this will be the key, or one of the keys to understanding what really happened on March 13th. First of all, like you said, this occurred on March 13th, 1997, 11:19 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. 80 miles off the coast of Norfolk, Troubleshooter 615 had just dropped off a SEAL team at one of the amphibious bases here in Virginia Beach, and was returning to a tender, you know, a smaller boat that would refuel it on its way to the aircraft carrier Kennedy. And from the report that's been published, which is, by the way, published almost 6.5 months after this happened, there was not a single news story reported about this. In fact, I think if you go to try and find this in the Virginia Pilot online, or, you know, even if you're a subscriber and you try and get the archives, for some reason you can't find the story anymore. But I have it, and it's real, and we've got the original paper, so it's not like, you know, conspiracy theory or anything like that. But for some reason, if you type in Troubleshooter 615, you will not find it. Okay?
You will not find it.
You will not find it. You may after tonight.
Yeah, exactly.
And the reason I'm telling you this is because I want everybody to think I'm this, you know, marvelous investigative journalist, and it didn't happen like that.
Well, and let me be pragmatic. Okay, so it was a crash. Okay,
yeah.
It crashed. It happened. It was an accident.
Well, let's talk a little bit more, because it's important to understand what happened. This thing, this Troubleshooter 615, four very seasoned people on there, the pilot, the co-pilot, two guys in the back, were coming into land on the tender. The standard procedure is to take off their night vision goggles. And the report says that it was coming in fine, everything smooth, clear, moonless night. I mean, it was absolutely clear night. No weather conditions that would have caused any problems. And just as it's about to be coming into land, it does a rotation. Do you know what I mean by a rotation? It pulls off from the landing, and as it does so, it has to dip its nose forward and really put on the power, you know, pull the handle up, and rotate forward to get, because it's coming in towards the back of the boat. And then what it has to do is it has to dip forward, go to the right, and put full power on. Well, apparently it just went straight into the ocean right next to, and again, this is the official report. We don't know what happened. This is just what the government says happened, okay? Nobody was out there. We don't have any independent investigation, you know. So we don't really know what happened, okay? Well, they did an autopsy in the official report, and they said that they found no drugs, there was no mechanical problems, there was nothing wrong with this helicopter or its crew that they're aware of. Well, that, I saw this in the paper, could not believe it. Because by this time I had found out about what happened in Phoenix. And I'm thinking, oh, my God. You know, we have a plane, and only because I'm from Norfolk. You remember this happened 80 miles off the coast of Norfolk, and my sighting took place the night before in Norfolk on March 12, 1997. So I thought, God, there's got to be a connection to this, you know, somehow.
Yes.
And before that, the day after, I had found out, I was watching television, really literally right after I got fired, and saw the whole thing come down with Clinton and his knee in Florida. And I thought, well, isn't that strange, you know? But I didn't know about Troubleshooter 615 at the time. So I had the new little bit of information. Peter Davenport found this out, and I think Mike Fortson did too. I don't know if it was all independent, but, and I'm sure that there are probably a lot of witnesses out there that kind of made this connection too. So I don't think I'm alone in this. And I know, as a matter of fact, I know I'm not alone in this. When you look at the times, this is the key, okay? The published time of the crash of Troubleshooter 615 was 11:19 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Now, when I had gotten in, I got every news report I could find that was published on Clinton's injury. And for those of you that don't know, on March 14th, it was reported that on March 14th at sometime around, I don't know, between 1 and 2 a.m., that Clinton President Clinton at the time in 1997 was upstairs in Hobie Sound of, what was it, Greg Norman.
Greg Norman, the golfer, right?
Yes, yes.
He was Greg Norman, yeah.
And
that guy wears that big hat.
Nice place to live down there. Yeah. I like to live down there. And apparently, you know, Clinton had injured his knee bad enough that he had to be taken to the hospital. And the scuttlebutt, you know, the sort of link that is made is that, you know, that something happened, and again, this gets into sort of the DEFCON thing with the satellite being disabled on March 13th and all that, that basically the you-know-what hit the fan on the national level, and that the Secret Service freaked out, and, you know, either they jumped on him or they were, you know, rushing him to someplace, and he tripped on something, and he blew his knee out, you know, really bad.
All right, now let's elaborate a little bit about this, Bill. Are you saying that somehow this UFO episode may have contributed to Clinton's injury because they tried to cover him up or something, protect him?
Yeah, basically.
How do we stretch that? I mean,
Well, it gets a little bit better because I just got an email. Again, the times are, so basically what it means is that. If you correlate 11:19 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to Arizona time, which is 2 hours behind, it's at the exact height of the Phoenix lights. You follow what I'm saying?
Okay.
In other words, these events are happening simultaneously.
All right. So you're saying they get a report that there's an object unidentified, even though it's in Phoenix.
Right.
Cover the president, even if he's in Florida.
Well, three things going on. You've got
unless you get one in Florida.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. You know, we know they were in Phoenix. I'm assuming that something happened to Troubleshooter 615, 80 miles off the coast of Norfolk. And there's a history of that. Okay, there was Fighting Tiger 524 that disappeared in the middle of the daylight on February 22nd, 1978. It caused pandemonium in St. Flat. And as a matter of fact, that's how they developed the special rules of engagement, I've been told, for these things, SROs. And that's on the website, too. You know, got the whole story on that. And they never found the plane. They never found it.
Now, that's weird.
And it happened 100 miles off the coast of Norfolk, the same thing. Not only did they not find the plane, it was an A6 intruder bomber. There was no distress call. There was no ELT, which is an emergency locating transmitter. Nothing. From one sweep of the radar scope, it went from being there to not being there. In the same area that Troubleshooter 615 went down. And again, there's another guy named Jim Knopf, who was an old Navy guy, who put it. And again, it was going to the aircraft carrier Kennedy. And you have a third event that happened also 100 miles off the coast that was reported by Jim Knopf. I have it on my website. Who was a Navy guy in 1971 that said there was another UFO event in the same area. Now, what's really interesting here, Peter Davenport, I got to thank him for this. He saw what I had posted because nobody knows about Troubleshooter 615 because it wasn't reported. I saw it because it was in the Virginia Pilot. I'm from Virginia, and I knew about what had happened to me, and I knew about the Phoenix, and I was able to put it all together. It was really dumb luck. I can't, you know. Just, you know, I'm not genius, whatever. It was just dumb luck that I happened to read the newspaper that day. Because if I hadn't, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about it. Well, Peter just sent me an email. He said that actually there were two stories out. The first story was that it happened around on March 14th. I'm talking about Clinton now and hurting his knee. The first story was that it happened, you know, somewhere between 1 and 2:30 is what, you know, various reports.
By the way, email Peter because Tommy's been trying to call him tonight and he can't seem to get through. Tell him to send us a phone number. And then to Peter Davenport.
Okay.
And then I want to get him on with you for just a second or so, maybe during the last half of the hour.
That's going to be hard to do. I got to hold the phone and type.
No. Do it during the half.
Oh, okay, cool.
We'll do the break.
Well, listen, so he sent me this email. I want to read it to you real quick. It says, however, so the first thing was that it would happen between 1 and 2:30 a.m., which on March 14th, which would have put it about 2 or 3 hours after the initial Phoenix Lights event and after the Troubleshooter 615 crash. However, and this is from Peter Davenport, God love him. However, Greg Norman, the host of the president that night, reported to Jay Leno during the Tonight Show that the president was not in the house, but rather in the driveway, and that the alleged injury, and again, it's alleged. Well, we know he had surgery, so it was an injury.
Well, I mean, it was an injury, just to know how.
Right, exactly. Here's the rub of it. Injury had occurred at 23:30 hours on March 13th. This is coming from Greg from Norman. Okay, not the news reporting agency, which said it was later on. Now, what's mind-blowing to me, and I just found this out, and I cannot believe this, if this is true, that means that at 11:19 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Troubleshooter 615 takes a dip in the Atlantic Ocean for no reason whatsoever, right? Apparently, right? That's the story that they put out.
Right.
10 minutes later, at 22:30 hours, which is 11:30, on the same night, on the East Coast, in Hobie Sound, in Florida, Clinton blows his knee out. Simultaneously, at 9:19 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, Arizona time, we are at the height of the Phoenix Lights. So, you know, I find it hard to believe that it's all just a coincidence.
Well, you know I don't believe in those.
I mean, you know, you get one thing, you get two things, you get three things, you know.
All right, let's move on to the satellite.
Yeah.
That something happened to that. This is fascinating.
And I have a theory behind this, too.
All during the same time period now, right?
Yeah, same night. March 13th. And there's way more. And you can see it's on the website. I mean, this just gets deeper and deeper. You know, the whole comment about, you know, communism, it's a riddle wrapped in an enigma and a, you know, whatever, and a potato. I mean, this has got nothing. That's got nothing on this. Bill Hamilton reported that he had received a report. We're still trying to corroborate it. I don't know if it's been exactly corroborated, but, of course, information like this is rarely corroborated, especially if it comes from a military source. But apparently, we know for a fact that there was a satellite called the Misty 3 satellite, which is miniature, individual size, transmitter, or whatever. It was just a bunch of instrument packages on a satellite. It's a miniature satellite. Miniature packages on a satellite. So it probably would have had various sensors on it. Infrared, ultraviolet, who knows? Different kinds of sensors, you know, measuring different spectrums. And apparently this Misty satellite was covering North America. And the thing was that it wasn't destroyed. What had happened, the report is, that a spaceborne object was observed passing over the satellite and drained its batteries. Drained its batteries.
I love this.
Now, here's where it gets really juicy. The manufacturer of the satellite, and this is Bill Hamilton who broke this story, and I think maybe Mike Forsman had something to do. I'm not really sure. But anyway, those guys, you know, whatever, they need to get credit for it. The satellite manufacturer was actually out of Arizona. I guess the military decided, after they found out that this satellite was disabled only because the batteries were dead now, that they were going to test fire a new developmental laser that they had to see if the laser would work. Now, the manufacturer of the satellite said, "What are you doing, man? I don't want you to blow my satellite up. There's nothing wrong with it." Well, the military went ahead and did it anyway. So this satellite, which was apparently covering North America, was disabled, and I have a theory behind this that what happened possibly is that there's no question that these craft are invisible to radar. And that makes sense to me because either the propulsion drive, whether it's anti-gravity or zero spin, or, you know, there's really probably more than one way to do it.
They wanted that satellite out of the way.
Yes. Well, it sounds like, oh, the game's up, the jig's up, folks. Boom. Satellite's gone.
Yep.
I think what happened was that those guys, those four brave pilots, and who knows what their true mission was, and it was called Troubleshooter 615, you go figure, okay? Was coming in. The standard operating procedure is for the two pilots to take their night goggles off because when they get close to the ship, the lights will blind them if they have those on. And they need time to adjust to those lights. So they take them off typically, I don't know, 5-10 minutes ahead of time. I could be wrong, but, you know, a good, you know, not 2 seconds before you're getting ready to land. You know what I mean? I think what happened was that probably one of the two other guys in the back didn't take it off. And I think as they came in on approach that there was a boomerang-shaped craft, which from a satellite, looking down, would not see by radar, but you'd be very difficult to hide the heat signature or the lack of a heat signature. In other words, you would see a black hole if you were looking at it through an infrared scope.
Boy, Bill, they could knock out every satellite that we have if they
wanted. But they didn't.
No.
But they didn't.
They just took one out.
Just the one that they had to.
Maybe, or maybe to tell us something.
who knows, man. But you know, but it says something that the batteries were drained and not just destroyed. It's almost like a velvet glove. It's like, yeah, what you just kind of hit on. It was like they could have if they wanted to, but they didn't. But why? Why didn't they just? If they have that, you know what I mean?
Tell me about this gamma ray burst also that Hubble kind of got captured,
This just gets deeper and deeper and deeper.
I mean, and there's more of these we're going to talk about tonight.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, and again, all of them are on the same time period, other than the 52 wave over Norfolk as well. But tell us about Hubble. What did it do?
What happened? Gamma ray bursts, just real quick, because people may not know what they are the largest. A gamma ray burst is the most amount of energy that's released by any type of space event that we know of. And a gamma ray burst, just to give an example, can last anywhere from 10 seconds to a couple of minutes to, you know, a couple of days. Well, maybe not that long, but they've been known to be observed, you know, not as strong as before. But the point is that they will release more energy in a very short period of time. We're talking minutes, seconds, hours maybe, than the whole sun will release in its whole lifetime. And in a few seconds, that's how much energy is released. And some of these gamma ray bursts will release more energy than 100 suns in that lifetime. And scientists these were actually discovered by satellites that were sent up, the Vela X5B satellites, which were sent up right around the time we landed on the moon. And at first they were top secret because they were supposed to be looking for gamma ray bursts, and these were the signatures of nuclear explosions. And we were trying to, you know, see what the Russians were doing. But I have a pet theory that I do believe the gamma ray bursts, there's no question, some of them are caused. You have soft gamma ray repeaters and SGRBs and stuff like that. Some of these are caused by collapsing black holes and supernatural stars. And there's 1,200 papers a year that have been published on this stuff, trying to, you know, figure out what it is. No, I don't think anybody has the absolute definitive answer for every type of gamma ray burst. There are different kinds. But I think at least some of them are the byproduct of extraterrestrial craft. Because if you have attained the technology to travel vast distances across time and space, I'm going to imagine that it requires a vast amount of energy.
I see where you're headed with this.
Okay. So, you know, possibly, yeah, they might have been looking for gamma ray bursts in the Earth, but you know what? A lot of those satellites weren't pointing towards the Earth. Okay? They were pointing out in space. And so what happened on March 13th was that the Hubble Space Telescope, for the first time in history, which kind of indicates that possibly they had a heads up that something was going to happen, a gamma ray burst took place on March. It was called GRB 970228, which basically just means February 20th, 1997. Which, again, is, if you go back and look at the history of the UFO reports, is basically when the UFO flap kind of began. And increased until March 13th. But gamma ray burst 970228, for the first time in history, Hubble Space Telescope took a picture of what's called an optical transient. Up until this time, no optical telescope, was able to actually take a picture of a gamma ray burst. So we knew the energy that was being expelled. We had a good idea where they were coming from, but we never had a picture of it. That's all I'm saying. By the time it had come and gone, we turn, you know, can triangulate where it was and pick it up and point a telescope at it, we didn't see what was there. This was different. On March 13th, 1997, not only did the Hubble Space Telescope get a picture, but the New Technology Telescope in La Silla, Chile, took a long, close look at those coordinates and discerned a diffuse, uneven glow. That same day, Hubble Space Telescope later resolved to be a bright point surrounded by a somewhat elongated background object.
Hubble may have captured that. Just incredible. We'll come back in a moment. We'll talk about some UFO escapades 55 years ago, also in Norfolk. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, tomorrow I shall continue the mystery. Who does Ian Punnett look like? Lex has been working his tail off, and we'll post the results tomorrow on the coasttocoastam.com website. I don't think Lex has a tail. He's not an animal or anything. Sorry about that, Lex. But we'll do that. Who does Ian Punnett look like? Hey, by the way, we are coming down to the end where we are giving away two free shows. The old classic Art Bell shows, interviews with the late Father Malachi Martin on demons and exorcisms. It's yours when you subscribe to the After Dark newsletter by calling 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Interesting, 1952, I believe that was when we had the flap over the Capitol in the White House. Remember that?
Yeah.
Well, it happened in Norfolk, Virginia as well. What happened?
This is where it really gets fascinating, because I had no idea that Norfolk, Virginia, had so much UFO history. I'm from, obviously, you know, like I said, South Boston originally. So when I moved down here, you know, had no interest in this stuff. And then after my UFO sighting, of course, I bought every book you could that had UFO in it. You know what I mean? Even if it looked like a UFO book, I bought it to try and, you know, figure out what was out there, what was in print, what was out there, because until something like this happens to you, it's not real. Just like Peter Jennings said, you know, seeing is believing. And the 1952 incident was something that I had to research because it was so old, and I really lucked out. And the reason I lucked out is because in 1997, they republished the UFO evidence, which I'm not sure if you recall, but it was the original NICAP book of the sightings that went back all the way to the 50s.
This was not the Project Blue Book?
No, this was NICAP.
NICAP's
book.
Yep.
Okay. This is the original.
All right. No, I don't remember that.
It was before Blue Book, I believe. I mean, it was like the original organization that investigated UFOs. And Donald Kehoe, I can't remember if he was a colonel or not, or I believe he was a colonel. I know he had...
Major, wasn't it Major?
Might have been Major. Yeah, Major Donald Kehoe, that's right. I love it when I can talk to intelligent people that know this stuff.
I love it when my memory still works.
Yes, and he wrote this book called Flying Saucers Are Real. He wrote a couple of books, but this book in particular, and of course the UFO evidence, which led me to the book, had a report, and this is what really blew me away, was that if you look at where the UFOs originated, there were two big reports. One was, I believe, on July the, I got the website right here, I give the exact information. Why wing it? The summer of 52, July 14th, 1952, in over Norfolk, Virginia, there was two Pan American pilots coming from the north, going to the south, I think going to Florida, witnessed saucer-shaped sort of, they could have been tied together, but sort of the globe, you know, saucer orb sightings type deal, and saw it come over the area of Norfolk, in the general area from where I'm from. I've got two conflicting reports, I think, on that one, where the maps are slightly off. So I'm not sure which one's real. I think the guys that did it are dead, so you can't talk to them. But at any rate, they were coming from basically within, I would say, a quarter mile radius of where I saw my UFO drop out of the sky. And terminating both sightings. Now, there was one, the Pan American sightings on July 14th, 1952, and then there was, which was called the Nash Fortenberry UFO sighting. And then there was another sighting on July 16th, 2 days later, by a guy who was on the opposite side of the channel looking towards Norfolk, who was an aeronautical engineer.
Now, were these boomerang shaped?
No. Well, you know, that's the thing.
Who knows?
Well, if you read the description, what it said back then was that there was, I could scroll down and look at it. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There were 6 disc-shaped objects which moved in unison, turned in unison, and went in a different direction, basically made like almost a 180, it looks like here. And then 2 other disc-shaped objects, similar disc-shaped objects, joined them. Now, let's assume for a second, and this is one of the observations that I made about the Phoenix UFOs, the Phoenix boomerangs, was that their bend seemed to be much greater than mine. The boomerang that I saw had like a 5 or 10 degree dihedral bend. In other words, from straight to a bend, it was maybe 5 degrees on each side, so about 10 degree bend. Not very much. But a lot of the objects that were seen in Phoenix appeared to be much more comparator shaped, like a 90 degree bend. You follow what I'm saying?
Yep.
So let's assume just for a second that these are swing wings, that they pivot. And why wouldn't they? The F-14 contact they can go across. They can do this. Why not? And it might have something to do with speed as well, just as the F-14 Tomcat, because as you change the geometry of the three, obviously, I think these are somehow the power comes through these, whatever it is, anti-gravity, whatever, these domes. This is what keeps them up. And so perhaps this was in a straight configuration. They couldn't see what was behind it, because if these things are bright, you can't see it. You can't see a body if they're really bright. You know what I mean? So your question, could this be like that? Yes. But unfortunately, we're not going to be able to find out, because the people are dead.
All right, yeah. But an incident that occurred, they seem to go in waves, don't they? Flaps as well.
Yeah, yeah. People have tried to correlate that. I haven't really seen one yet that really, you can find a direct correlation. I think, and I'm going to make a prediction here, I could be totally wrong, but I think in the future we'll find that the gamma ray burst signature situation is what's going to reveal it.
That is fascinating.
It is fascinating, because there are very few things that can explain that much energy being focused. See, that's the thing about it, it's focused energy. At first, the cosmologist thought, well, it had to have been expending too much energy. It was just impossible. And then they refined the theory, and they said, well, if we focus that energy, like lens it, you know, like through a lens, from a black hole or a collapsed superneutron star, blah, 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 you know, different theories, that's how they could concentrate the energy. But we found from GRB 970228 and another one in 2003 that the light, the optical part of it at least, was like 87% polarized. And what that means is there's a huge magnetic force associated with that. They predicted with the theories that they had that it would be low, 5, 10, 15%. So it was like 10 times bigger than they thought it was. Well, that's exactly what you would expect if you were curving and bending space in order to, you know, bend space-time in order to shoot something out.
Didn't the Air Force, Bill, stand down non-combat operations for a couple days during this period?
In September 16th, 1997, I believe. I have it on the website. Yeah, they did. They stood down for 24 hours. They had a series of three crashes, I think, in 3 days. But even more than that, in 1997, for the first time in history, all five U.S. aircraft carriers were reported. That hasn't happened since Pearl Harbor. In addition to that, and I'm going to take you on a little trip here. Do you remember the A-10 pilot, Craig Button, that just took off in his A-10 jet and, you know, apparently committed suicide?
I remember that. Yes, I do. Okay. Right. That's what he smashed into a mountain, didn't he?
Yeah.
Okay.
For no apparent reason whatsoever. Bizarre. Totally bizarre. Never been explained. Then 6 weeks after that, his trainer, Amy Lynn Svoboda, Captain Amy Lynn Svoboda, from the same base that he was at, died in an A-10 crash. And then I think there were 8 A-10 crashes that year. I could be wrong. I have to go back and double-check that. But basically what happened was that there were so many crashes. And also, too, that year, there was the Baltimore, and there's a lot of scuttlebutt with this, too, and who knows whether it's true or not, that stealth bomber wing just popped off in the middle of flight, and that the scuttlebutt with that was that it actually had hit, cloaked.
Crashed with a UFO?
Right.
Yeah.
So for the first time in history, I believe it was September 16th, 1997, they had a stand down.
Again, might not have anything to do with this. However, again, it's weird.
You know, you have to, the hard thing to do is just take a step back. You know, don't focus on each and every individual occurrence. Just take a step back and try and get a picture of what was going on a national scale. Look at the ripples. You know, you throw a rock in a pond, you don't have to see the rock hit the water to figure out where the rock hit the water after it hit the water.
Well, let me ask you this, which could be the most controversial question of the night.
Uh-oh.
The lights in Phoenix,
yeah,
some have said, match the one seen at Fatima, Portugal, in 1917,
yeah,
when they saw the miracle of the sun. They think the sun came down.
You, yeah,
remember that?
Yeah.
Was it really a mass UFO sighting back in 1917, or was the sun really coming closer to the planet?
Just so you know, by chance now, okay, this wasn't planned, I traveled to Fatima on September 13th last year. And, yes.
And I think Sister Lucia had probably died by then.
Yeah, she died, I think, in 2000.
A couple of years before.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes, the answer to your question is yes, yes, and yes. And, you know, the Virgin Mary apparitions And when you study them, it's not flah, flah, flah. I mean, they've got pictures of this stuff in Zaytun, Egypt, when she appeared there, to the Muslims who aren't even Christian. They're not even Catholic. And they report seeing the Virgin Mary in Zaytun, Egypt. Then you've got, of course, before Fatima Lourdes. Okay?
Right.
And how would we know the difference prior to 1947, prior to War of the Worlds, let's put it that way, which I think came out, when did that come out? That came out
way before that.
Yeah, 1917. But at any rate, you know, I don't know that War of the Worlds was a huge, you know, thing on the farmer's mind in Portugal.
I'll get the exact date for you in a second.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever been to Portugal, it's farmers. It's, you know, it's, you know, these people are simple people. No offense. I mean, they're beautiful people.
Well, I've always had, and people who believe in miracles say, no, it can be done, but I've always had a problem thinking that the sun came so close to the planet.
Of course not. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
They saw something, but it wasn't that, I don't think.
No, no. And you know, there have been sightings that just where you've got the multicolored, you know, sparkles, whatever, coming off and spinning and all that. You know, that could be a plasma field. That's exactly what you would see in a rotating plasma field around an electrostatically charged craft, skin of a craft. You know, and that's exactly what T. Townsend Brown was working on with his Brown Beale field effect and the orbs that he had perfected for the Naval Research Laboratories in the early, you know, late 30s and 40s. So, you know, but this, of course, is 1917. So, you know, even
1938, by the way, for the War of the Worlds.
1938. Yep. 1917 is when this happened. So the people didn't even have the lexicon to describe a UFO, even if they knew what a UFO was, which they didn't. You know, so how would anybody know any sufficiently advanced technology is either going to look like magic or God unless you've got...
No, that's true. That's a good point.
You know, so... So, yeah, and this comes from Jim Dilatesso in the Phoenix Lights, and it's really amazing that this would even come up because it's never been pushed. Link Katai wrote about it in a book. It was buried in the back of the book, almost in the appendix, really. You know, because no one, there's the habit, not the habit, but I guess the UFO researchers in general, and I'm an investigative journalist first, and a UFO researcher second, but I think a lot of UFO researchers tend to stay away from the religious aspect of things and not even really touch it with the 10-foot pole. Not all of them, but you know what I'm saying? Because they don't want to mix the two up. And it's really amazing from a social standpoint of view because if you get on, like, alien UFO forums or something like that, there are two things that are most hit. That's religion and UFOs because they go together so well.
I think Dr. Barry... can't remember Barry's last name, but he believes in the angelic UFO cases.
And, you know, I got to be honest with you, I can't rule that out either. Can't rule that out either.
How about this tribe, the Dogon tribe? You've heard of them, right?
Spell it.
The Dogon tribe, D-O-G-O-N.
Oh, yeah, in Mali, Africa, sure.
They, of course, the Sirius star system.
Yeah,
they
Robert Temple.
Yeah, exactly. But,
yeah, they, Sirius is, has an orbital period of 50 years. They're Sirius A, B, and C. And they knew what the orbital period of Sirius B was, and it's a white dwarf star system. And we didn't even know what a white dwarf was. We couldn't even define it until, what, the late 70s? But these people knew the orbital period of it can't even be seen by the naked eye. And they've known about it for at least, I don't know, by some accounts, 350 years or more. They really don't know because the way that they recorded their information was on, you know, stuff that really couldn't be carbon dated. And they won't let you carbon date it anyway.
They do some kind of sacred dance by shamans.
They
right?
do a sigui.
Sigui.
A sigui. And this is really wild the way I found this out, okay? Again, you know, I just pay attention to stuff, you know what I mean? The human brain is a pattern recognition machine. All right, I'm not extraordinarily bright or brilliant or anything like that, but I just see things and I remember them, and if something's odd, it just stands out and I see it. So I'm watching a documentary on the History Channel about Hitler and how he had sent these teams of, you know, scientists out in the early 30s trying to find the Holy Grail and all that, and they came across the Dogon tribe. and they documented that it was just a blurb that they had this thing. It's called the Sigui, and the last time it was in 1937 because it was about Hitler and the rise of Hitler and all this crap. So I thought about this, and I researched it more, and they have it once every 6 years. So they had their Dance of the Sigui in 1997. And so their whole system, their cosmology, is based on these 20-year cycles that are conjunctions of Saturn, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what was really interesting about that is they represented it, and I'm kind of going all off here, but I think you'll like this. They represented this 20-year cycle by a black and white alternating triangle pattern.
I love it.
And that black and white, you know what I'm saying? That now that looks just like the step pattern in South America on the was it Chichen Itza?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It represents it almost perfectly. And I thought to myself, you know, what are we looking at here? And I got a book one time called Heaven's Mirror by, what was his name? Not Bavall. What was the other guy's name?
Hancock?
Yes.
Graham Hancock.
If you can get your hand, have you heard of it, Heaven's Mirror?
Yeah.
His wife is a photographer, and he documented all of these ancient sites all across the world that are repeating these same Orion configurations, and it seemed to be a lot of Orions. He kind of really made that point. And interestingly enough, he was doing this around the world right in 1997. So
everybody was doing this in 97.
Yeah, it was really.
Okay, why didn't they come back tonight? It's the anniversary.
That's a good question. What makes you think that they left?
Well, I don't.
I think they're waiting to see what we do. I think they've been waiting to see what we're going to do for a very long time. And I think that they've always been here. And I think that, well, maybe not always been here, but they've been here before.
I think Temple's work with the tribe is phenomenal. I have no idea why it hasn't been exploited and investigated.
Yeah.
Because these people probably have the answer of an extraterrestrial star system.
Well,
you know, that's where, if we haven't already, that's where we should be beaming our SETI signals. You know what? Right.
Well, do you know that GRB that we were talking about? Yep. Do you know where that was? The origin was from? Just right outside of Orion's Belt.
That's right. That's
came from
right.
Orion's Belt. In fact, when I saw my UFO, it had passed in front of Orion's Belt and blinked off the stars, which is just, who knows, you know, where it was before. It's just a thought that passed in my head. But, this just gets deeper, deeper. And one thing leads to another. Gamma ray burst leads to this, and Troubleshooter 615 leads to 524, and 524 leads to Clinton, and Clinton leads to the satellite. It's just like, what the hell is going on? Now, do you remember 3 days after Clinton hurts his knee, 3 days after March 13th, 1997, 3 days after the satellite goes down, Clinton says, we got to have a summit. And for the first time in history, the prime minister of Russia met in the think tank in the Pentagon to talk about a summit they were going to have in Helsinki on March 22nd. And March 22nd is an important date.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come back. We're going to continue the discussion with Bill Warrick, and then we're going to take your phone calls. Here's the special line for those of you in Phoenix who witnessed 10 years ago that incredible sighting. 818-817-0021.